We'll move into the last formal speaker, and we do have time at the end for a bit of a panel discussion. It is Dr. Fahey, opioid-sparing practices in surgery and transitioning of care to the outpatient setting. Thank you.
I want to thank our moderators and the college for the privilege of the podium. And I think one thing I'd like to emphasize is you're already hearing that this is really a team sport, and engaging anesthesia, don't forget to engage palliative care. And that's not just for the cancer patients, and I'll highlight that in the case I'm going to present. So I don't have any relevant financial disclosures. And what you've already heard is that postoperative pain management really begins with a perioperative plan, and that you've heard a lot about patient and family education, the preoperative assessment, the intraoperative plan, and that means you actually have to talk to the anesthesiologist. They're good people. Don't be afraid. You heard a fabulous talk about multimodal pain management. And then my part is really to talk to you about how do you get the patient from the hospital to home and hopefully not back to the ER or back into your office unexpectedly. And my mother, may she rest in peace, was famous for prior proper planning prevents poor performance, and it really is like you have to have a plan, and particularly in the patients that you know are going to be challenging up front. So there are three major stakeholders. Patients care about their pain control. They are interested in being functional at the end of whatever it is that you're about to do with them. They don't want complications. And for the most part, they don't want to come back to the hospital. Well, as providers, we also want our patients to have good pain control. We want them to go back to their prior level of functioning if that's at all possible. We don't like complications, at least I don't. I hate readmissions, and most of us don't want a lot of phone calls, so how do we avoid that? And then our payers, the folks who are paying us to take care of patients, they also want their patients to have a functional recovery, and what we're talking about is when can you go back to work? Somebody was talking in the Sunday session about if you're the third-party payer in Detroit and you have a lot of folks that are working on a line or in manual labor, you care a lot about this because you want your people back working. And then third-party payers want quality, and that also kind of ties into this avoiding complications and readmissions. So here you go. This is the overlap. This is the part that I'm going to be talking about, is what is the relationship between postoperative pain control and avoiding complications and readmissions. So many of you are already, hopefully not because of adverse financial repercussions to you, but about the hospital readmission reduction program, and this was part of the Affordable Care Act, really focusing on the fact that 20% of Medicare hospitalizations are followed by readmission within 30 days. These are not planned, as you might imagine. Talking to patients beforehand, the surgical patients, is going to be an important part of this, and coordinating with their primary care providers or their other providers at follow-up. And a lot of this comes around, again, the issue of pain management and what role it plays in these hospital readmissions. So I'm going to give you a case of RC. I guess not every 50-something-year-old woman has rectal cancer, but here you go again. This is my patient. Her treatment plan included neoadjuvant chemoradiation. Then she got a robotic low anterior resection with a diverting ileostomy. She has the comorbidities that you heard about from Dr. Napolitano's patient also, of mood disorders and hypertension. She had an appendectomy. She's on venlafaxine, oxycodone, 10 milligrams every 6 hours is needed for the rectal pain associated with her tumor. She was a widow, and this is important. She had been widowed with about a year prior to all of this. She smoked but quit 5 years ago. She reported 1 to 2 beers a day, and then actually only after I talked to her breast surgeon found out that she also used some methamphetamines, but no history prior drug use. So she obviously had some red flags. Her mood disorder was a red flag for me. Their current medications of an antidepressant plus her preoperative opiate use, her alcohol use, and I'm Irish. I can tell you 1 to 2 beers a day. It depends on what you're talking about, right? Are you talking about a pint or what, a little one? And then the substance use that she had. So we know from really outstanding work from the Michigan group that the independent predictors of new persistent opioid use are preoperative tobacco, their alcohol and substance use disorders, having preoperative pain, and then mood disorders. And there was a really excellent talk from Dr. Inglesby, I hope I didn't butcher his name, who said that really chronic opioid use is probably the most important postoperative complication. it's not sepsis, that's part of what we're responsible for, and I think that's a really important and powerful way to frame this discussion. So this is really great work also from that same Michigan group looking at, well, what is the impact on patients who are taking opiates preoperatively on outcomes after major abdominal surgery. And so they looked at 2,400 patients. These are non-emergent abdominal pelvic operations. It was a binary variable. Were you taking preoperative opioids or weren't you? And then the outcomes they looked at were 90-day hospital costs, length of stay, 30-day major complications, discharge destination, and 30-day readmission. And importantly, they found out that 21% of their patients were on opioids preoperatively. And again, this is a mixed bag of patients undergoing non-emergent operations. And what they found is you'll see that with the opioid-naive patients being in blue and the preoperative opioid users being in that kind of orange color, that there were significant increases in 90-day costs. Their length of stay was significantly higher, major complications were significantly higher, and hospital readmissions. And they looked specifically, and again, for those of you looking for some CME, what specific complications were they at risk for? And they were primarily infectious related. You see any type of surgical site infection, including sepsis, and a trend toward pneumonia. This is some really nice work that's coming out of the Stanford group with Dr. Hahn, and they looked at the VA SQIP data, 237,000 operations, so large, from that database, and looked at overall 30-day unplanned readmissions and found that happened in 11%. And again, this is just from a VA group over about a four-year period. And they found that the risk factors, patient risk factors, were older folks. Unfortunately, the guys had a harder time. Those that were not married were totally dependent functional status preoperatively, so not coming into this, not in the greatest of shape, higher ASAs, and then having comorbidities. Well, but what contribution did pain have? And what they looked at was the highest postoperative pain scale. And so still using that number, because unfortunately we're saddled with it whether we like it or not, this is what we're still having to be charted and so forth, is that for those that had higher maximum postoperative pains, there was a kind of a general trend up toward your increased risk of a postoperative admission. And so, again, just these are the folks that we need to be looking at. If you're having patients who are reporting 10 out of 10 pain, these are the ones that we have to devote more resources to because we know that they're going to be at higher risk for a readmission. This is a follow-up from that same group, now looking at their, again, kind of trying to dive into this a little bit more in a more granular fashion beyond just that maximum postoperative pain scale. Same database, again, but now looking at six distinct pain-reported pain trajectories, and those were that were persistently low, that were mild, moderate, high trajectory, mild to low trajectory, and then moderate to low trajectory. Again, just trying to understand how were patients doing, were they progressing as expected, or were these folks that were having sort of escalating pain prior to discharge? And so this is just showing you those six groups, and you can see the four different outcome measures of any unplanned readmission, ER visits only, a pain-related readmission, or any postoperative discharge complication. And what they found is that those with the high pain trajectory were four times more likely to require a readmission for pain compared to patients in the lowest pain trajectory group. And importantly, this was not related to complications. So it's not just that if you had a complication, you had more pain and you got readmitted. This is independent. This is specifically the contribution of that pain trajectory during your hospital stay. So, again, for the CME, those interested, so postoperative pain is associated with what percent of postoperative readmissions? 2%, 10%, 15%, or 25%? I'll let you kind of noodle that privately for a second. 15%. That's a lot, folks. And so thinking, again, about it's, yes, infectious complications are really important, but pain, again, as a form of postoperative complication, I think is something we really need to be focusing on. And then so what? How do we help these patients transition? I've talked to you kind of about who do we need to be on the lookout for, who are the patients or the scenarios when we're at risk. So it's assessing their pain management needs in the 24 hours prior to discharge. I have great residents, but everybody gets the same amount of scripts going home with, regardless of whether they were taking their IV hydromorphone every 2 hours prior to discharge or they hadn't had any for 2 days prior to discharge. So I think you really have to get in there and look and see what the patients, what they were using before. You got to know where they're going, and this has to do some with who are you going to need to coordinate with, and the other is also what kind of support is that patient going to have. So if they are going home, who are their people? Who's going to be helping them manage whatever it is that they need to be functional at home, and also engaging other providers, and then got to have a plan for how you're going to follow them up. Who's going to see them and at what time? One of this, I'm going back to my patient of the rectal cancer. So as you've heard over and over again, scheduled acetaminophen and ibuprofen, gabapentin. She's on a higher dose because she's a younger lady and can tolerate it, but I would totally echo, be careful in the elderly. And then the number of oxycodone pills that she went home with mirrored essentially what she was on in the hospital with a taper plan. And so this is a table that you've seen before. This is just shocking to my residents who are like, what do you mean they're not all going home with 60? It's like, no. Again, what you've heard before is this is procedure specific. And then in her, for my own patient, in addition, her postoperative pain management plan is not just her scripts. It's a whole education piece that happens both before and just at the time of discharge, and that includes a weaning schedule. We heard a nice presentation from Dr. Groster on Sunday about a weaning schedule they're using at Wake Forest, again telling them the importance of avoiding benzodiazepines and other sedatives, avoiding alcohol, abstaining from illicit drug use. And I think you just have to be very candid with these patients about you can die. And I have had patients go, really? You're like, well, yeah, duh. But I think it is. It's worth saying it out loud again. We heard a little bit about opioid storage. I think this is our responsibility to educate patients about this. And I also like the idea that opioids are like chemotherapy. And patients have to be consented for chemotherapy, and I think they should be consented for opioids and understanding the side effects and the risks and benefits. And whether or not that's formalized in a contract or not, I think kind of depends on the patient. But good idea, though, just to reinforce that this is a very different than you going home with your other medications that you're going home with. And then again, part of her plan is communicating with her outpatient providers. This particular patient did have a palliative medicine provider, and calling him and saying, hey, Doug, this is what RC's going home on, and so that we're all on the same page. I can check the PMP, our prescription monitoring program, just like he can, but making sure that he knows exactly what I said, because I don't know about your institution, but my discharge summaries don't get to my referring providers in a timely fashion always. And then her follow-up, a call at 24 hours can be huge, and hopefully you have support from nursing, advanced practice providers, but checking in, did you actually pick up the script? Are you using the scheduled medications like I told you to? How are things going at home? Was there something unexpected? Oh, yeah, my daughter was supposed to stay with me, and now she's not, and I'm having to go to, you know, Costco and go get my groceries. Well, we got a problem. And then I'm getting a short interim follow-up, and that means checking the prescription monitoring program, figuring out, does RC really remember what the opioid weaning plan was? Is she adhering to it? And again, that follow-up with her providers afterward. So in conclusion, both patients and providers and payers, we all have a stake in both safe and effective outpatient pain management. 15% of postoperative readmissions are related to pain. Preoperative opioid use is associated with higher costs, longer length of stay, more complications, and more readmissions. And readmissions are correlated with that higher maximum postoperative pain score, so really being on the lookout for those. These are patients that maybe they need another day in the hospital, maybe they need shorter follow-up, maybe they need a referral to somebody else before you send them home. And then that transition is really about thinking about this beforehand and coordinating with their other providers. I appreciate the privilege of the podium and your attention.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much. The speakers stayed right on time, so we do have time right now built in for a question and answer period, which Dr. Vanover is going to facilitate. Go ahead.
Sure. So I'm Melissa Vanover. I'm a fourth-year resident from UC Davis, and this has really been just kind of an honor to be involved in any way in this panel. We already heard, there's a lot of great talks from our speakers here about particularly preoperative planning, provider expectations, your perioperative plan, as well as your inpatient and outpatient transition. So I guess we'll just open it up if anybody has questions.
If you do have questions, please come up to the mic, because we are trying to record it so that folks can learn from this remotely. Thank you.
There was a study that came out just in the last couple of months that somebody had done a survey surgeons across the country, and you may have referred to it. I didn't hear. But they looked at the number of pills that people were given, particularly of Percocet, and the median dose that, you know, half above, half below, was about 30. And in that same study, they contacted patients, and the average number that people took was 3.7. The interesting paradox there is that for example, in North Carolina, there are limits on how many days worth of prescriptions postoperatively you can give. On the other hand, if you give small doses and you're going to redose somebody, because if say you give them 10 pills instead of 30, if they come back and they need a couple of more pills, you get dinged for giving another prescription. So the question is, how do you balance trying to reduce the number of pills you give somebody in the immediate post-op period? Because I personally have changed to 20 from 30, just because everybody seems to do fine with it. But the fact that you're going to get dinged if you redose somebody afterward is a problem. How do you balance that?
At Penn, what we've done over time is taken a look at the data that people have used on procedures-specific medications or amount post-op. We started with cesarean section, and then we looked at a number of different orthopedic surgery cases, and then moved to breast cancer surgery and so on. And one of the things statistically that's very, very common is that it's almost like an 80-20 rule. The curve is not a mean in the middle, but rather there's a large group of the patients, about 80% of the patients, that use a very low dose of opioids. And then there's a long extended tail where if you prescribe high doses of opioids, there's a small subset of patients that will take everything you give them. And that actually drives the mean a little bit farther to a higher number. So when you're looking at a procedure-specific prescribing process, you actually don't prescribe to the mean. You prescribe to that 80%. And the reason is that excessive amounts of opioids in the community and in the home is actually highly dangerous. And so not talking about policy, not talking about being dinged, the right thing to do is to prescribe the amount of medications that will allow about 80% of your patients not to have any need for additional medications and have a very small number of leftover medications, and then to be comfortable in assessing your patients and deciding whether or not another additional opioids is medically indicated. Sometimes it is, oftentimes it is not, and that requires an assessment. And then from a systems point of view, as we mentioned, is make it easier for you to do. So if you assess the patient, it can be by the phone, you make a determination that they need some additional opioids, if you can prescribe them electronically, which is allowed by federal law, then you can accomplish that without requiring the patient to come and collect another prescription. And to a fair degree, we've had tremendous success. And in follow-up calls, when we've done that, it's extraordinarily rare that you end up prescribing additional opioids. If you prescribe down to the 8 to 10 tablets that meets that note, and there's no the magic number should be the number. It doesn't need to be rounded to 20 or 10. It can be 8. It can be the right number of tablets for that particular procedure. And very rarely do patients contact to ask for additional medications in that sort of scenario.
Yeah, thanks again for these talks. They're very interesting and informative. Again, Johannes Schneider from Western Canada. When I started practice in Canada, we got these triplicate prescription pads, which I put in my office drawer. never took them to the hospital for these surgeries that we do that go home the same day, like gallbladders, et cetera. If a patient would ask me for a significant pain reducer like Tylenol and Codeine, and said, well, I don't have my prescription pad, and I like you to go home on acetaminophen and ibuprofen. Doses of ibuprofen and Toradol, like for the Tylenol, we have this number, 4 grams in our head maximum, and for ibuprofen, my number was always 1,600 milligrams per day. And I see that some people prescribe 600 milligrams 4 times a day or 800 milligrams. And is that the same for large people and less large people, et cetera? How do we sort of find our way through the dosing in those circumstances?
I think the maximum dose has always been for me 800 Q8 or 2400 a day. Obviously, if they're very small, 600 TID, I think you can go by body weight, but you can give pretty high doses. And again, it's amazing the equivalency to opioids. I just adjusted.
I'm Wayne Moore from LaPorte, Indiana. Many years ago, when I joined my senior partner, he recommended Valium for the rectus muscle spasms. And I can tell you that it works very well. I'm curious if the panel has any experience with that and how it compares to Flexeril.
So we used Valium for rectus muscle spasm when we did component separations, and we found it had a higher rate of sedation, so people felt a bit sedated on it. But other than that, it does work. But that was one of the reasons we use Flexeril when there's a lot of spasm. I can tell you we see a lot less spasm when we titrate and use gabapentin ahead of time. I don't know if the panelists same.
Yeah, I used a lot of Valium as well for abdominal wall muscle spasms, but now I use a lot of Robaxin, particularly because it's available both intravenously as well as orally, and I think I've had equivalent efficacy without as much sedation, so they're getting up and walking, which is huge.
Joe Schwartz from Boston, Massachusetts. Question first to Dr. Ashburn and one to the rest of the panel. First question, you talked about the use, I think, of these elastomeric pumps for shoulder arthroplasty. I recall hearing some warning advisory some years ago about increased risk of infection with the use of those, and I think they were discouraged for a while. I don't know where that stands now. And the second question is with regard to the liposomal bupivacaine. What are the economic restraints on that? Has that been a barrier to getting this medication widely available in your hospital?
We have not had significant incidents of infection, but we're pretty compulsive at having them removed on day one or day two when the patients go home. And, of course, we try not to spit on the catheter as we put it in and use sterile technique. And in most of the regional anesthetic techniques, actually, proper sterile technique, including getting the skin clean and sterile and doing proper bandages and wearing a mask, are actually some of the key things I'm predicting. And some anesthesiologists are better than others at doing things properly. With regard to expensive adjuncts like IV acetaminophen and bupivacaine, that is an arm wrestle. One of the key things is to demonstrate value with those medications by being good stewards. Our opinion of the literature is that acetaminophen is as effective orally as it is IV, so in our protocol, we made IV acetaminophen available only if we pinky swore to move people to oral medications whenever they started being able to tolerate oral medications or when the surgeon said that they could swallow with a sip of water. With regard to the bupivacaine, we only use it for wound infiltration in our practice because the data are most robust for that, and it's done within the context of an integrated plan. And so if we have an integrated plan, multimodal treatment algorithm, then we can use it in that setting.
We also use elastomeric pumps in our elderly patients who have laparotomy because it's a painful operation, and we don't have liposomal bupivacaine because it's too costly in our institution. We follow our SSI rates very carefully, have not seen any increase.
Could I just quickly take the moderator's prerogative to announce that this is supposed to be the general session for this, but we recognize that it's a complex issue of managing pain, and so there is a second part two that does follow this. So for all of you who have questions about how do you manage the patient who's actively using chronic opioids, how do you treat patients with opioid use disorder, how do you treat geriatric patients, we will go into detail on that in the second session. So just stick around or take a break and come back, but we'll finish questions here too. Yeah.
Hi. Sorry, I don't have much voice today. Adrian Gann, I'm in Westchester, New York. A couple of comments and one question with regard to, again, EMR technology, hospital systems. One of the problems I tend to have at my institution is that the pharmacy requirements have all gone to a pain scale, not just a pain designation, for instance, for being able to prescribe PRN medications. My standard talk before surgery, after surgery, and most, probably 80-90% plus of my patients as a general surgeon are doing Tylenol and ibuprofen alternating. I write them as standing orders, Tylenol Q6, ibuprofen Q6. Every 3 hours they get one or the other, starting within 1 to 3 hours after surgery, with an Oxyaz breakthrough, which is almost never used. So they don't need to go home on much. But finding a way to do those standing orders and then the PRN orders when I was trying to do it PRN has been very difficult because you can't write first line, second line. You've got to write pain 4 to 6, pain 7 to 10. Most people escalate that and use the opioids at the top of the scale. When I want first line all the way through and a breakthrough, for instance, if they're 7 or 8 to 10 after the non-opioid has been given. Have any of you had issues with that in your institution, and how have you dealt with trying to set up order sets that work within the requirements?
In ours, we've been emphasizing, again, the use of procedure-specific multimodal order sets that are developed by we. As a pain specialist, I meet with a particular group of division of surgeons, and help them with specialty information on developing order sets. We also do have a multimodal standard order set that is across all systems in all six of our hospitals. And so we offer a standardized setting, which is more generic, and then we offer the other. With regard to acetaminophen and ibuprofen, we agree that it should be scheduled as opposed to PRN, and we don't write them concurrently because of the potential risk of toxicity with both drugs if they're given at too high doses. So what we did on the order set is you can click one or the other. You can't click both. So if you want to use on the generic multimodal order set, it says ibuprofen 600 Q6 scheduled for X days, and the physician puts it in. Or it says 600 Q6 PRN, and the same thing for acetaminophen, and we strongly encourage people to do that. One trick when you're setting up order sets is put what you want on the top and put what you don't want, but everybody wants to have that option, on the bottom. Because inevitably, when you do that, people will select the top button about 80% of the time. So if you want scheduled ibuprofen, put it on the top and the PRN on the bottom, and the same thing for the others. And we do the same thing for our opioid discharge orders. We put the smallest number on top, and that's the number that's usually picked.
So I'll just to directly answer, the pain scale component is supposed to be linked to the PRN component. Because if you aren't asking the pain scale, then it's... So what we had to do was we had to tell our IT folks when we were building our order set and have a discussion with our pain management and our pharmacy team in the same room and say, no, these are for pain, but they are not on the pain scale. They are scheduled. And right. So in our order set, much like he was just saying, our order set then comes up and it's pre-checked. Tylenol, ibuprofen are pre-checked. They have to uncheck them. And it's linked to the particular procedure. But even if you don't get that complex, just convince them that the Tylenol opioid that you want, or the Tylenol and ibuprofen that you want scheduled, is not part of the pain scale algorithm.
That's how I kind of eventually got around. I started scheduling those. And just to reiterate the concept of how many you send someone home with, you know, when I do write opioids to go home with, I think my standard number these days is 12. And my practice does not write opioids outside of the hospital. So they know they can't get a refill. And I can count on probably both hands the number of opioid scripts I've written to go home after, mostly, you know, hernias, gallbladders, appies, in about a year and a half, which I think has been a big win for us.
And the one caveat I don't think has been mentioned, but if you're asking people to take Tylenol, please don't put them on a combination pill with Tylenol. Same with ibuprofen. Some of the some of the pills that you're used to prescribing are combination pills, but just think about that. Like if your discharge instructions are saying take Tylenol and then you're giving them a Percocet, which has Tylenol, it gets confusing. So.
And I would add to that, I think it's important, you know, we've all dropped our opioid dose on discharge, but I think for many of our operations, it should be zero. You know, so lap appies, lap colies, really nowadays hernia repair should be zero. But I think this concept of if they're getting some opioids in hospital, you do have to de-escalate while they're in-house if you had a complication.
Hi, Art Cooper in New York. I'm a pediatric surgeon. We use a lot of rectal Tylenol as adjuncts to our procedures, but I haven't heard that mentioned here with respect to the adult population. I just wondered if you'd comment on that. Thank you.
We don't use it.
Don't use it because you don't need it. It does work, and we use rectal administration and palliative care at end of life, particularly if people don't have access. But even that's changed with newer technology and ability to gain IV access in the home with ultrasonic guided access. And so basically with the options of this oral and intravenous acetaminophen, it's moot. It's less needed. It certainly is a way, effective way of delivering acetaminophen. It's just not the top choice by most of our patients.
Hi, Hale Wills, also a pediatric surgeon. I started using rectal Tylenol and got away from it because it has a 20 to 80% bioavailability, depending on whether it goes systemic or goes through the portal circulation and gets chewed up immediately. Interestingly, we switched over to using IV Tylenol, and now at three institutions, I sort of went through the same fight. Oh, it's $60 a dose. But then we say, well, almost every drug given to a neonate or to a small child is drawn off in a small alcove in the sterile hood. So you can actually get the dose cost down substantially by working with a pharmacy and having a plan when you're doing scheduled dosing by that same $60 to $80 bottle being distributed over several patients. So one $60 bottle could treat the entire NICU for a week if managed properly.
Okay. Great, thank you. Thank you to our panelists. This was an excellent session. I really enjoyed it, and I know I learned a lot. And thank you, everyone, for coming. Have a great day.